Since the early days of the pandemic, scientists have warned of airborne transmission of COVID-19. Indoor air quality and ventilation systems, they've made the headlines. We're spending the hour on the indoor air we breathe here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some businesses and school districts have retrofitted their HVAC systems. They've brought pricey new filters. There's the low-tech open the window technique, letting in outdoor air to help dilute particles and droplets that contain the virus. So do you have concerns about air quality in your home or at work? What do you want to know about improving indoor air? We're at 800-642-1234. Timothy Bertram is a professor in the Department of Chemistry and an affiliate professor in Atmospheric and Oceanic Studies at UW-Madison. Tim, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thank you for having me. I enjoy talking about this important issue.
This is your bread and butter. So what factors affect the quality of the air inside our homes and where we live?
Oh, there's so many things indoors that affect indoor air quality. And usually where I start when I talk about this is I talk about outdoor air quality, right? So outdoor air quality is what is conventionally regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency. And we know a lot about outdoor air quality because it's what we monitor routinely. And so indoor air quality, of course, the air that's indoors starts outside, right? So we need to first think about what the air quality is in the outdoor environment and how much of that outdoor air that we bring indoors. Right. And so we can talk about what's in the outdoor air, right? Or we can talk about all the things that we add to that air once it's inside, right? You can think about all of the sources of potential pollution that you might add indoors, right? Everything from when you're cooking on your stove to vacuuming, or if you have candles in your house, they're all contributing to the air that we're breathing indoors.
Okay. So the outdoor air is kind of like your baseline, if you will, and regulated by the EPA. And then that air is coming indoors mixed with all of these other influences and things. But it's really tricky because it's not like some people are coming inside every single indoor place to judge that air and find out what's healthy and what's not. So as a starting point there, what are the sources of indoor air pollutants?
Right. So if you start with outside and you think about that, what are some of the pollutants that are coming inside? A lot of people, this is, I think, a really interesting time to be thinking about indoor air quality, because you can ask yourself the question first, is the outdoor air cleaner to breathe than the indoor air? Right. And in this pandemic that we're in, everyone will categorically say, outdoor air is cleaner. Please give me more of that. Right? Let's give all the outdoor air. Let's bring it indoors and flush out the indoor air because it could have this respiratory virus in it. Traditionally, for indoor air quality, usually the assumption there is true in that way. But then you look at other places around the country, like you look in Fort Collins today, right, where they have a massive forest fire that's outside in the foothills. And the outdoor air quality there is absolutely terrible. And you'd be thinking about running it in the reverse way. But I think your question, you know, goes back to this idea of, you know, we can somewhat get a sense for what's in the outdoor air quality and what's contributing to that, right? We see all of the combustion sources, the mobile sources that might be in the vicinity that we're living in or working in. In the indoor case, right, we have to sort of start to break it down by activity. Right? You can start that activity by thinking about, perhaps even in the simplistic way, or what are some of the things that you do in your house that trigger your smoke alarm? Right. We all have that problem. Right.
Yeah.
And we can see that with the haze that we generate when we cook on our stovetop. Right. And that even can bring down to the function of, you know, how good is the vent above my stove, my gas stove, my electric stove. Right. And what am I even cooking and what temperature am I cooking it at? Right. That's one of the biggest sources of indoor air pollution is what we're cooking and what we're doing on our stoves. Outside of that, you can start to think about anything else that is a combustion process, right? If you're going to be burning a candles or if you're going to be having an indoor fireplace, right, that is not properly ventilated, right? You might get some backflow from that. Those are some of the main primary things that you can visualize, right? You can really see when those are bad. And then you can start to think about the secondary things that you might not be able to visualize, but you can smell, right? We all know when you try to clean up a mess, right? And sometimes you make it worse, right? Because you bring in all of these fancy solvents that are intended to clean up some visual spot. And all of a sudden your home just reeks of all of the solvents that you just used in your house, right? And the first thing you do is you open the windows and you try to flush the air out. So we all sort of have in the back of our mind sort of this idea of how do we know when there's poor air quality and what do we do about it, right? I mean, when my smoke alarm's going off, right? I just don't sit there and wait for it to go away, right? I mean, I open up all the windows, right?
Right,
and
right.
Maybe I put a fan
you
in the
start
window.
Start waving your dishcloth at, you know, anywhere and everywhere.
Exactly, right? So we sort of already know some of these things about our houses, right? Even if you had some detergent or something like that or some smell, you kind of know how long it lasts, right, before it goes away. So you can sort of go down that road, right? Things that maybe you can visualize that are pretty obvious, like cooking or, you know, a fireplace or candles. And then you can go down the list of, you know, cleaning products and things like that. And then you also get down the list of things like when you vacuum, right? When you vacuum and you're intentionally trying to clean up the carpets or whatnot, you're resuspending a lot of the dust and particles that are in the carpet itself, and those get brought back up into the air. So indoor air quality, it's been studied for a long time. There's lots of information on this, both from the scientific standpoint, but also just from people observing in the time that they spend indoors.
I'm going to reintroduce you here. We're talking with Tim Bertram, who is an expert in air quality, environmental chemistry, and chemical instrumentation. We're discussing indoor air quality as the CDC laid out this month that airborne transmission of the coronavirus can occur due to inadequate ventilation or air handling. What questions do you have about particles in your air inside your home, your workplace, your business? What do you want to know about filtration systems, how they work? Does anyone in your family have asthma? What have you done to try to make your indoor air healthier? 800-642-1234. Tim, I want you to take us back to the 1970s when there was this thing called sick building syndrome. I mean, the buildings were trying to reduce energy consumption, so they were being built sealed up tight, and that really affected indoor air quality. Do we still see sick building syndrome?
Sure. So, right. So this is an interesting question. I think about the way that we build buildings, right? I mean, we have these two facets here. We have a facet that we're trying to build buildings tighter and more efficient, right, for energy purposes. And that's a big deal, right? While we're in a pandemic, we're also, you know, if I put on my other hat on our other interests here with outdoor air quality and climate, right, we have to be really mindful about the energy that we're using. So that's a really big deal, right, about making efficient buildings. Now, there's a trade-off there, right? If you have a building that's not ventilated at the rate that you would like, sure, you're going to have these issues that keep persisting, right, about indoor air quality pollutants and the effects that they have on our own human health. Now, one of the challenges with all indoor environments, right, if you kind of step back, like we spend, I don't know what the current number is, something like 90% of our lives.
Yeah, that's
right?
Crazy.
I mean, it's nuts. But the thing is, if we think about, hey, if I spend 90% of my life outside in Madison, I could pretty much tell you what the air was that you breathed over you breathed over the course of your life. But if you say I spend 90% indoors, you've spent it in all of these heterogeneous environments that is really hard to get a snapshot of, right? And so, sure, if you work in this business or in this building or live in this house, you could experience pretty different air quality between each one of those places.
We're gonna pause right there with UW-Madison atmospheric chemist Tim Bertram, who's our guide to the air we breathe in indoor enclosed spaces. We're talking about ventilation and about indoor air quality with your questions, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tim Bertram here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about indoor air quality this hour of the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is about the air in our home, in our schools, in our offices, other buildings. According to the EPA, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, indoor air can be up to 5 times more polluted than typical outdoor air. And we spend the vast amount of our time indoors. And then amid COVID, ventilation and filtration could help make indoor spaces safer. So what questions do you have about, you know, high efficiency particulate air, HIPAA filters, the MERV system that measures a filter's effectiveness? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison chemistry professor Tim Bertram, who's our guide. So, Tim, we were talking there about sick building syndrome and the effects when on a person's health when indoor air is not good, is unsafe. What can you tell us?
Right. So, I mean, sick building syndrome, right, encompasses many, many things, right? It's hard to pinpoint exactly what the root cause was for a pollutant, right, and directly linking that to an effect. And in the indoor environment, there are many different types of pollutants that might lead to an effect on health. As we sort of, I think, guide this conversation around for indoor air quality that we've already talked about for sources of pollutants or this idea of airborne transmission that we'll probably get to. One of the things I think that we want to get to talking about are what are the pollutants and how do we think about them, right? And so when we start to think about what those pollutants are, I think perhaps what we need to talk about, and you can tell me if this is a good time to do that, is to talk about these ideas of particulates and aerosol particles and how those particles are characterized, how big are they, where they come from, and things along those lines as they contribute in a dominant way to health in the outdoor environment. And as you just said, their concentrations can be much higher in the indoor environment. And so sort of getting an idea of how you characterize them, what they are, how big they are, I think is really an important part of this conversation that leads into how we think about respiratory.
Right. So these particulates, they can come in different sizes, and the virus, the coronavirus itself, has a particular size of particulate. What can you tell us there?
That's right. So the first thing about this is that particles, of course, aerosol particles, aerosol being the suspension that the particles are in, so I often call them just aerosol particles or particles, have a real continuum of size, right? They can form from sizes that are very big, almost that you can see, that might be sort of like the thickness of your hair, right? Very big particles that might be like a grain of sand on the beach. The particles that we often think about that are suspended in the air, right, that are not feeling the forces of gravity, are about 100 to 1,000 times smaller than the width of your hair.
Okay? Wow.
So they're really small. Now, the virus itself is on the order of around 100 nanometers in size. So that's, 1,000 times or more smaller than the width of your hair, depending if you have thin or thick hair. And so you can kind of start to think about those size of particles versus what you can see and what you can't see, right? So, right, when you have your vacuum cleaner go through, it makes a little dust cloud, mm-hmm. right? You can visually see actually like individual particles because they're nearly the size of your hair. When you're cooking, we were talking about where you see that kind of haze, that smoky haze often that sets off your smoke detector, you're not usually seeing individual particles. You're kind of seeing all of them, right? You're seeing this mass collection that changes the ability to see the light through that.
Like a cloud, yeah.
Through those particles. Exactly. It's like a cloud. So it's got this wide range, right, of particulates. And depending on how big they are, it depends on how long that they live in the air, right? So if you've got a massive particle, it's going to feel the effects of gravity. It's going to fall out like a raindroplet almost. If you've got a really small particle, it doesn't care. It doesn't care that gravity is really there. It's just going to move around on the air currents in the room. And so the size of these particles is a really important part of this whole puzzle as we start to link it from things that we've thought and spent a lot of time thinking about, which is sources of air pollutants and particles in indoor environments or outdoor environments, how they move around in the indoor and the outdoor environments. And we start to transition this now to this idea of respiratory aerosols, right? And these are the particulates, of course, that we're exhaling during various types of activities, right? You're exhaling very small numbers of particles, even when you're breathing. When you're talking, you start to produce more particulates. Those are formed from film rupture all the way down in the base of your lungs, all the way up through your larynx, and then even into your mouth. When you're singing or yelling, you just make more. And when you're coughing or sneezing, you make millions. And they come in all different sizes as you're talking yelling, singing, you know, or coughing. And the key, you know, to this whole puzzle is there a virus in that aerosol particle? And in what size particle is it found? Is it only found in the really big ones, or is it also found in some of the smaller ones? And that's sort of the key part of this that that a lot of folks have been thinking about over the last, you know, 6 months or so, specific to COVID. People, of course, have thought about this for influenza and other things for years.
We're talking with Tim Bertram, who's an atmospheric chemist and our guide to indoor air quality this hour. And we're looking at, you know, all this stuff that's moving about us in the indoor air, the particles and cleaning, improving what we inhale inside. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris in New Berlin, maybe. Chris, hi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Berlin.
Just Berlin. Okay, go ahead.
You all are leading up to this, but my question is about HEPA filtration. And, for instance, how do we know how often should we be changing our filters on our furnace? And with the placement of HEPA filters, I was at a wedding recently where the gathering place at the bar, there was a HEPA filter on the floor. And is it your feeling that it should be placed close for getting large particle, or should it be a little bit more distant since small particle apparently are spreading 20 feet, 25 feet? Mm-hmm. What do you think about where do you put your HEPA filter?
Yeah.
Right. Chris, this is a great question. So there's a couple parts to this. I mean, the first part is when do you know when to change your filter, like your furnace filter and things like this? I mean, the vast majority of people don't change their furnace filter often enough, and you know it. As soon as you pick it up and you go, oh man, I should have changed that thing, you know, years ago. Usually what happens with them is a lot of the furnace filters, they don't actually get worse at filtering as they get older. Oftentimes they get better, right? Because there's more stuff that gets crowded in there. But it strains the furnace system, right? Because it's harder to push air through that filter, right? So it's often not that it's the furnace, the filter itself will get worse. It's more that it loses its ability to push as much air through it. So there are certainly ways that you can test for that. Even cheap ways of, you know, if you're looking at your vent, your supply vent in your house, and you put a piece of Kleenex up against that, you can see how much that moves. I think the second question is a really interesting one, though. People are now starting to think if they're in an indoor environment or an indoor business that they have found the ventilation isn't good enough, that maybe they want to supplement that with a HEPA filter, a standalone HEPA filter unit, or even some of these makeshift units that you can make using a box fan or a handful of furnace filters themselves. So you can sort of make your own. And the question is, where do you put it? This one is a constant discussion. Now, I would say if you put it on the floor, right on the floor, you're drawing air right from the floor itself. And this is actually kind of problematic because a source of a lot of particulates can be from the carpet or things like that, or the flooring itself. So you're kind of drawing air directly from that. So if you can get the HEPA filter up a little bit off the floor, that's usually helpful. For the idea of airborne transmission of particles, if we're talking about these smaller particles, usually they're pretty well distributed around the room, right? They start to break down this idea of the 6-foot rule, right? They start to become dispersed throughout the room. And so the placement of the filter may not have a huge impact on the air quality because they're well mixed in that room. So you just want to turn air through the filter itself. So oftentimes people say, try to put it in the middle of the room in the average place there. The second sort of practical side I often bring up here is some of these HEPA filters or the filtration units, or even the ones that you might make yourself, some of them are loud, right? And if you're in a classroom, you're trying to teach students, they're annoying, and you may just turn it off if it's too loud. And that's the last thing you would want to do. I mean, if you went to all this trouble to get one of these devices, and they do really help, even just for indoor air quality, you want to make sure it's something that you can use. And so if it's really loud, you might think about the placement of it relative to the speaker, because what you don't want to do is to have people yelling in your room as well.
So when you look at the various grades of these HEPA filters, how does that work in terms of what they filter out?
Right. So Right. So if we go to our furnace type filters, right, we've all stood in your favorite hardware store, right, and stared at the furnace grade filters, right, and they have different, usually sometimes they've just distilled it down to good, better, and best, as opposed to the fundamental rating on them. But I'll talk about the rating. Right.
And
so
we're going to let's just pause here on the rating because, you know, I know we're all really interested here. We have UW-Madison atmospheric chemist Tim Bertram as our guide to indoor air quality. And we're looking at the air we breathe with your questions about filters, about HVAC systems, about opening up a window. And you can join in 800-642-1234. We're going to be back to this discussion right after a news update with Tim Bertram here on the Ideas Network. We're spending the hour on indoor air quality here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Stagnant air, it may affect us in ways we don't realize. A U.S. Government Accountability Office report from June said schools spend billions of dollars a year on building and renovating facilities. About half of districts need to update or replace multiple systems like heating, ventilation, and air conditioning, their HVAC systems. Is your school or campus going through these upgrades? What are you installing or changing? Join in at 800-642-1234. We have Tim Bertram, who's our guide. He's a professor in the chemistry department at UW-Madison. Tim, we left off on the rating system on air filters and that good, better, best system. What do you see out there?
Right. So this gets tricky, right, when you hear all these acronyms and you want to ask, what are they actually doing, right? And so I think when I talk about this, the first thing we need to step back and think about is what size particle are you trying to get rid of, right? If you're trying to get rid of a really big particle, something that might be the size of your hair, right, that's pretty easy to get rid of in many types of filters. If we're trying to get rid of a particle that is 100 times smaller than my hair, that we would say, you know, might be on the order of 1 micrometer or something, or even smaller, that's where we start to talk about these HEPA filters, these high efficiency particulate air filters, or the MERV rating for the filter, because the rating of that filter is tied to how many particles they can remove, right? So if you're thinking about indoor air quality, we might be thinking of trying to reduce the concentration of particulates in the indoor environment that might be smaller than some specific value. And usually that specific value is what we can breathe in, right? That's why EPA regulates particulates of a certain size. Sometimes you hear that PM2.5, particles of mass, particles that have diameters less than 2.5 micrometers, right? Mm-hmm. So those are particles that we can breathe in. So you might think, I want to get a filter that's going to remove out particles that I would otherwise breathe. So if we start with that, you can think about, let's get the best filter I can get, which would be a HEPA filter. Now, HEPA filters are designed to remove out, I think the number, it's like 99.97% of particles that are around 300 nanometers or 0.3 microns in diameter. That's really small. This is a really good filter. If you're trying to clean the indoor air environment, essentially what you're limited by is how much air can you get through that filter, right? You want to know how many liters go through that filter per minute, because that's what's going to ultimately clean your air. Effectively, everything that goes through there is going to be removed in the context of this respiratory aerosol discussion. The second part you see is things like your furnace filters, right? Or if you're going to make your own home filter unit, right, with a box fan and a MERV filter, something like that. You see the filtration ratings, these MERV ratings, which stands mm-hmm. for minimum efficiency reporting value. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense, right, in mm-hmm. terms of the acronym, right? But it has the same thing. It has an efficiency for removing particles based upon their size. So if you were to go into your hardware store and you were to pick up one of these filters and you say, okay, there's a MERV 8, and then next to it is a MERV 13, right? And one of them costs twice as much as the other one. what are you buying, right? You're essentially buying better filtration for smaller particles when you move between those. So in terms of like numbers, if you buy like a MERV 8, which is kind of like a good filter or something like that, a MERV 8 filter removes maybe about half of the particles that are around 1 micrometer in diameter, and maybe about 10% of those that are around 300 nanometers in diameter. Remember, the HEPA filter takes essentially them all out.
Okay.
If you were to move up to a MERV 13, right, that's, which you hear that number as sort of a standard often, you know, hey, does my office have a MERV 13? I mean, my 9-year-old son, you know, is like, how many air changes are there per hour? What's a MERV 13? Do we have MERV 13s? I'm like, what are you doing? But, you know, that's been often, people may not even know what MERV stands for, but they know they want a MERV 13. So, you know, MERV 13, what that means for that filter, right, is that it's going to remove out about 95% of the particles that are around 1 micrometer in diameter. That's an area that we think, you know, a respiratory a virus like SARS-CoV-2 could be present in. So a MERV 13 is going to remove about 95% of those. So that's pretty good in terms of a filter. Even if we're not talking about respiratory aerosols and we're just talking about good indoor air quality, right, which is also really important, a MERV 13 filter is going to do a great job of removing out these particles as they're just recirculating through our households if we keep the fans on. So that's sort of a crash course. It's a lot of details and things like that, but hopefully a little bit of a backstory of why some people are targeting this idea of MERV 13 filters.
We're talking with Tim Bertram, who's a UW-Madison chemist, an expert in air quality, environmental chemistry, and chemical instrumentation. He's taking your questions this hour on indoor air quality at 800-642-1234. Let's go to Conrad now, who's joining us from Madison. Hi, Conrad.
Hi, Tim and Kate. Thanks for taking my call. If
sure.
we look up indoor air pollutants at CDC, which is also very active in the COVID health program, we see one of the most important indoor air pollutants is radon, indoor radon from the decay of uranium with its long half-life, which is in the Earth's crust and even helps to heat the Earth's crust. It's so plentiful. It's the same for the World Health Organization. Radon is considered a major indoor air pollutant. And even the Health Physics Society of professionals who protect workers and the public from radiation has changed its position to make a statement that indoor radon is a major source of public health risk from indoor air. I wonder if Tim and our audience would appreciate giving us some analysis of why radon is not mentioned in his list of indoor air pollutants.
Conrad, thanks.
Sure. Conrad, this is important. Of course this is important. Radon is important. I think, and certainly by not mentioning it, I didn't mean to say that it was not important. I think this also highlights one of the key things about indoor air quality. There are many different sources of indoor air pollutants, right? I also, of course, didn't talk about asbestos or other types of things that might impact indoor air quality or just indoor environmental quality. Radon, of course, is important for the reasons that you mentioned. You know, it also has, there are similar approaches for trying to mitigate radon in your house. It also has the same components that there's wide ranges of variability in radon exposure depending on where you live, even if it's within Madison itself and where you spend your time, right? So, of course, normally we're thinking about radon exposure that's in our basements, in areas where the air might not be turning over as fast. And of course, as Conrad said, right, the primary source is that it's coming from the soils, and depending on what the foundation of your house is and whether or not it's a completely sealed foundation, you may have larger or smaller sources of that, or even the chance of where you live relative to those uranium deposits, right? That's important sources of heterogeneity in it. But I think there's a question that links all these things together, the sources of the pollutants and your exposure to them, is how much time air spends inside, right? And, you know, one of the best approaches for getting rid of if it's radon, you know, that may be attached to a particulate, or if it is a gas that's coming from your stove, is to turn the air over quickly, right? And that's the same strategy that people will use for radon, is how do we get the air moving in our basement so that you have this small source, but that you can get that source outside. So certainly, Conrad, radon is important. I'm glad you brought it up.
Taylor called in from Milwaukee, couldn't stay with us, and Taylor's been listening to the conversation, is an HVAC tech, and doesn't suggest anything over MERV 8 for a home. Taylor says it can run up coils and make all your motors run harder. The higher the number is more for office buildings, not for homes, Taylor said.
Yes. So this is critically important. And this is something that I think I mentioned earlier in this, is that when we were talking about filters getting clogged up and causing strain on your furnace systems, right? So that the higher the MERV rating that we have for these filters, of course, it's going to be a better particle filter. But if your system cannot be matched to a MERV 8 or a MERV 13 or whatever it is, you're going to cause undue strain on that system. So in the same way that people don't put HEPA filters into their indoor systems, right, you've got to match what that MERV filtration unit is to the system that you're looking at. So consulting an HVAC tech, consulting someone like Taylor is really important in these conversations.
Can you explain the air changes per hour, or ACH, and, you know, even just the idea of the old-fashioned open the window technique to, you know, improve and circulate the air?
Right. So you'll often, like I think I was joking about earlier today about my son talking about air changes per hour, right? We're just talking about how many times on average does the volume of air that's in a room, maybe it's your living room or maybe it's your office, get replaced with fresh air, right? So sometimes you'll talk about outside air changes per hour. So how many times does outside air come in, or how many clean air changes do you have per hour, meaning that the air is going through a filter and coming indoors. So you might hear this room has 5 air changes per hour, right? So on average, essentially, the air has been moved through there 5 times in an hour, right? So the higher the number, then the less there is going to be of accumulation of a pollutant in a room. Okay, so that's kind of a key component. Opening a window, if you're in a residential space, and putting a box fan or something like that in the window and having another window on the other side that's exhausting, is just going to improve that number of air changes per hour. I kind of like to think about a lot of these analogies about air changes per hour or filters in terms of the context of, for example, like smoking, right? If you're trying to remove smoke or if you're trying to remove the smell from a house, you want to think about opening a window, getting that air moved through, or increasing the air changes per hour in your space.
Tim Bertram is a UW-Madison professor in the chemistry department, and we're discussing indoor air. What questions do you have about ventilating, purifying, filtering indoor air? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Tim Bertram here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Let's get back to our conversation about indoor air quality with UW-Madison atmospheric chemist Tim Bertram. We've been talking about how viruses travel in these tiny specks of fluid, and these specks are large enough to be captured by some air filters. COVID-19 has drawn our attention to air filtration and ventilation, especially as colder temps set in and we retreat indoors. Let's take another call now. Mary is joining us from Madison. Hi, Mary.
Hi. So this is just a story or comment, but some good friends of ours live in Portland, Oregon, and during the recent events with the fires, they have 2 young children, and they were really struggling to keep the air quality in their house okay. And he told me that air filters were sold out just across the whole region, and he got lucky because he had purchased some really high-quality ones for his office. And so he brought some of those home, and they were just setting them up against box fans to try to filter the air inside their house. And they had to block off any opening, like into the house, I guess the fireplace, and it was so bad he couldn't see more than two houses down the street.
Oh, goodness. Wow. Wow. That is just incredible. Mary, thank you for sharing that. You know, Tim, this can get really dangerous.
Yeah, that's so I think this, Mary, this was an interesting comment, too, because I think it really highlights this conversation about the connectedness between outdoor and indoor air quality and whether or not your outdoor air is cleaner than your indoor air and which direction you want to be pushing your air, right? You're making this assessment, you know, for yourself based upon the visual cues you may have. And in times when you have a raging forest fire, like if it was Portland or if it is currently Fort Collins, right, you're going to be thinking differently about where you source that air. But exactly as Mary said, a lot of folks have done this. You know, take a box fan and take a set of furnace filters and made their own air purifying device. And I've certainly also seen the pictures from indoor environments of what those furnace filters look like, you know, after a couple days when they're in this air that's being influenced by these forest fires. And it's pretty scary to see those filters, but it's also kind of neat to see those filters and all the particles that are on that filter, and they're not in your lungs based upon that filtration.
William sent an email asking that, well, saying that, you know, he airs out his home every morning by opening the windows, wants to know how long should he keep them open to air out the house thoroughly?
That's a good question. And it probably varies a lot depending on, you know, how many windows you have and how big your house is. And whether or not you use a fan, right? You can do a really quick calculation to figure out how long it would take to air out your house if you used a fan, because you can look at those window fans. And if you look at the window fan and you look at the rating, it often tells you how many cubic feet per minute the fan blows. And so you could say, okay, this fan, maybe it blows 1,000 cubic feet per minute. Then you could look at your house, right, or the room you're trying to ventilate, and you could calculate, right, what the how many square feet it is and how what the ceiling height is and what the volume of that room is. And you can actually just quickly estimate how long it would take you to flush that room right out, right? And that would be an easy thing if it was just one room and one window that was blowing in and out. But you can sort of get an assessment of that. Otherwise, you can sort of use your senses for this, right? We all have embedded in ourselves, we have our senses of, is this room feel stuffy? Does it feel cold? Does the air feel stagnant? And sometimes just by that alone, you can get a sense for whether or not the air has turned over in the room.
Jean sent us an email asking, do houseplants improve air quality indoors?
There's been a lot of conversations about these, about houseplants. I think the evidence currently is that no, they don't have a significant impact on the air quality itself. If you wanted to think about, if you calculate out how much CO2 exchange might be in an individual houseplant relative to all the other sources of pollution, the air turning over, it's a pretty minimal impact, unless, of course, you live in a forest of houseplants themselves. That's certainly something people are very, very interested in. Mentally, they all help us out, right? Having plants in the house, though.
As we start to wrap up here, how do we monitor the air quality in our homes and ensure we're okay?
That's a critical question here, right? And I think I alluded to a few things, right? There are some senses that we all have about air quality in our house, essentially how stuffy your house feels, right, in terms of the temperature of our house. You can get a sense for the air exchanges from that alone, right? If you want to get more sophisticated in this, there are other ways that you can do this, right? There are folks that have purchased small CO2 sensors, right, that might be, you might be able to purchase that measure the concentration of carbon dioxide in your house. They're relatively cheap. And you can learn from that because we, of course, all exhale CO2. You can measure the concentration of CO2 in your house or in your workplace environment, and you can get a rough assessment of how often the air is turning over in your house. You can actually measure that.
Well, Tim, thank you so much for joining us. We're out of time.
Oh. Well, thank you for having me. It was fun to chat.
Tim Bertram is a professor in the Department of Chemistry, affiliate professor in atmospheric and oceanic studies at UW-Madison. As Wisconsin became one of the country's COVID hotspots, the debate over how much information the public should have about local outbreaks also heated up. For instance, the state doesn't report K-12 schools with confirmed cases, as some parents and teachers would like. But as Shemaine Mills reports, health officials across the state say they're walking a fine line between privacy and sharing critical information.
Back in March, when very little was known about coronavirus, UW-Madison student Amy Schursel announced on social media she had the illness. The 22-year-old wanted to warn other young people they, too, could be vulnerable to the virus. It kept her bedridden for 2 weeks with a fever, dehydration, and extreme fatigue.
So sick. I honestly never been that sick in my life, and I hope I'm never that sick again.
While most of the feedback she received was positive, some wasn't.
Other people who are like, she only got it because she's too fat. She's too lazy, and that's why she's sick. Just like really like mean stuff.
Schursel, who now lives and works in California, was also open about her name and her hometown. When health officials or school districts announce infections, they can't reveal information that could identify a person. But sometimes it happens inadvertently, especially in small communities. When Bayfield School District had its first known case of COVID-19, officials notified parents, students, and staff by text, telephone, and social media that a high schooler was infected. Word soon spread who it might be, even though gender, grade, or name were not shared, says an attorney who represents the school, Steve Weld.
You know, Bayfield, like most communities in northern Wisconsin, are small communities. Frankly, it didn't take Dick Tracy to figure out who was involved.
Bayfield Public Health Director Sarah Wartman later found out the infected teen and her family received unwanted attention on Facebook and at their home by people wanting to know if they were indeed quarantined.
Had I known that as it was happening and been made aware of it, I could have put some made some actions that could have been protective for that family, could have potentially offered to have the family or the person be put in a hotel room for their safety.
Or, she says, even posted guards outside the family's home to make sure, in Wartman's words, they weren't harassed. School districts and public health departments are both subject to laws that allow them to alert the community about infectious diseases, but they must try to maintain as much privacy for the individual as possible. Denise Chrysler is with the Network for Public Health Law.
With students, and especially students in elementary and high school, it's extremely sensitive whether COVID should have stigma or not have stigma. It does have stigma.
But Bill Leaders with the Wisconsin Freedom of Information Council says how people perceive COVID changes as more people get the disease. He stresses that details about cases is vital information the public needs during a pandemic.
Parents have a right to know if there have been cases of COVID-19 that have been confirmed in the schools that their children attend.
The Bayfield County High School case occurred in March. Now there have been more than 130 known infections in the county. Like the rest of the state, the COVID-19 cases come from workplaces, family gatherings, and sporting events. Keeping track of those cases is the job of state and local health officials who try to balance public safety with protecting privacy. Those who voluntarily come forward with COVID information, like Amy Schursel, may get a reaction they didn't want or expect. But she says she wouldn't do anything different. She didn't want anyone else to suffer. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.